All right, everybody, welcome to Lecture 23 in this American History program with History at Our House for the junior and senior high class. We are going to return to our theme of the Renaissance, but before we do that, we will do Facts Practice 1A again. So today we're going to cut the time down to 3 minutes, and we are going to conduct the Facts Practice. I am not going to record the Facts Practice drill for those of you on the recordings. But I'm letting you know that we are doing it and that I think you should too. So if you're going to be on the recordings, go ahead and pause the recording now, do your facts practice, and return to the recording, please. All right, so let me pause the recording and we'll do the drill live. All right, sorry, I have to unpause. So if you can't finish it in 3 minutes, you definitely need to practice. Now, of course, and I want to acknowledge this, everybody has a different handwriting style. Everybody has a different handwriting speed. So it's okay if you can't quite, but you should be able to, and you should strive to improve yourself to the point where you can do it within 3 minutes. And you let that be a measure of whether or not your writing and your writing style are where they should be at this point. Okay? And just keep practicing, basically. All right, so let us, instead of asking you the who, what, where, because I think you guys know them all, I want to ask you the so what's. So, who cares that Menes Narmer became the unified ruler of Egypt in 3000 BC. Why do we care about this at all if we live 5,000 years later than when it happened? Timothy, go ahead.
Because this system that Menes Narmer created, monarchy, is going to be the norm up until the birth of America.
Yeah, it's the norm. And so that means that it helps us in a variety of ways. What does it help us? In what way does it help us to identify that freedom is not normal? How does that help us? Is that a helpful thought? I mean, does that help anybody? In what way does that help you? Now we need to take it a little bit further here, because if you're just parroting the so what answer, that's not good enough, is it? Who cares if monarchy's normal? Okay, Timothy, keep going.
We live in an exception.
Yeah,
America is not normal.
Yeah, exactly. What you have is non-normal. But beyond just identifying that as a fact, Timothy, doesn't that affect you in some way? I mean, what is the follow-on thought here? We're not just talking about facts. What's the follow-on thought when you say freedom is not normal? Freedom is exceptional. What? Is that it? Is that just an academic fact? You're just going to write that out on a piece of paper and then, oh, okay, get on with life. Who cares? Well, the answer is, if it's not normal, then how come Americans have it? And what's that worth, by the way? And how special is what America represents? And do you walk around understanding that? Or, you know, how do you approach life in this wonderful, exceptional time that you live in? Are you one of these people who doesn't really get it? Who doesn't get how incredible the United States is? Because if you do, I really feel sad for you. Because you guys are young, so you guys still have time to figure this out. But the truth is, most adults don't get it. And it's really sad, because history is the tool, is necessary, really. To study history is necessary to properly appreciate this, how special the United States is. And so it's, when I think about it, it's amazing. And it helps, because there are a lot of problems in the world. There are a lot of negative things in the world. And all of us struggle to figure those things out and deal with them in our life. Well, as part of that struggle, we have to, it's nice to be able to look on some wonderful positive things in the world too, right? And just the very fact of the United States' existence as the preeminent nation in the world and the greatest one in the history of the world, that's something that should just be able to put a smile on your face no matter what else, and give you a certain inspiration and fuel to proceed to fight for whatever important values it is that you can define and create in your life. And for me, as a historian, I take an enormous amount of inspiration from the Founding Fathers, because they studied history and that's how they did it. So it's exciting to me. It's inspiring to me. Priya, what did you want to say?
I was thinking about it, and we used history to create what we are now. We didn't just think about it and say, oh, okay, we're gonna do something different. The Founding Fathers looked back and found out a lot of cool things through what we have recorded in history.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And you see, I mean, here we go with number two, which is what we're talking about today. And we're talking about the birth before the rebirth. Well, like you say, Bria, the Founding Fathers didn't come out, they didn't pull this out of a hat. It's not a magic trick, freedom. Freedom, how do you get it? It's one of those, and how do you keep it? And how do you sustain it over time? And maybe even how do you spread it? And how do you convince other people to embrace it? That's a really big challenge. And to understand it well, you have to look at the past. You have to look at all the successes and failures of societies over time, over centuries, over millennia. And that's exactly right, Bria. The Founding Fathers, when they enacted the rebirth, as we go to our timeline, right? 1776 is the rebirth of freedom on this world timeline. Well, we're talking now today about the birth before the rebirth. What were the positive steps that human beings had taken before the rebirth that inspired the Founding Fathers? When they looked back at the story and they said, well, all right, there's other people that have been thinking about this. What did they come up with? How good were their answers? So that's what we're eager to know here. And the answer to the so what about 508, 509 is that, well, these were the people who did it first. Firsts are so important when they matter, right? When we can remember them and when they are something that we can, this is a first, right? And this is a first. All right, and so much of what we're studying is something that's first in a way that matters to us through all the way thousands of years later. We still can see the importance of these things. And so let's take a look more closely now, because the birth of freedom is a very interesting time. It involves a lot of trial and error, and a lot of both, right? Because coming up with the right answer on how to organize a society, is that a multiple choice quiz? Is that some kind of simple, is there a recipe that you can just read somewhere and, oh, that's it. There's, do one, two, three things, and we're done. We're free. Like, is this a simple question? A simple issue, how to be free? If it was, then everybody would be free, right? If freedom was simple, then 1.5 billion Chinese would be free. But have you guys been watching the news on what's been going in Hong Kong lately? How they're having this event called this umbrella revolution they're having it over there. Now, they're really struggling. People in China have never, ever even had democracy, let alone freedom. And today we're going to understand better what the difference is. So boy, are they stuck. I mean, they have some freedoms, but they're very fragile. And they're not doing well because of it. And people that are free, they flourish. There's a reason why the United States is the greatest nation in the history of the world. And the basic answer is freedom. And that's it. When people are free, as the founding fathers realize, they live better. It's a natural condition for them that allows them to flourish. The more power and force and oppression and rule are a part of the way that people live, the more they malfunction and the more unhappy they are and the less well they live. So it's not easy to do. The Athenians and the Romans worked on this problem for the first time in any serious way in all of history. And they struggled with it, and they didn't get it right in all the crucial ways. We have to acknowledge that. But they took some important steps, and they struggled with this problem in a serious way. And the founders learned from them. So we're going to look at this birth. This birthing process of freedom is painful. We're going to look at it and try to understand what are some of the pains that are involved. Go ahead, Bria.
I was just going to say, they used a good example of and the bad in a way. If they took the bad examples, they could figure out what was wrong with them and think how they could make them better. And in a way, it was kind of like the Athenian democracy and Roman Republic was kind of like a crash course.
Yeah, you're right, it was. Yeah, so and the founding fathers were fighting the British Empire, so that was a crash course too. So yeah, let's go to the details here on democracy again, because this is where we started off. We saw yesterday that democracy is a word that has two parts to it, demos and kratia, and that this has a vague sort of connotation, which is the people rule. The rule of the common people. But when we take a close look at that thought, we see that, well, it's kind of a vague formulation. That if we are going to talk about groups of people ruling, we're going to have to really understand what is the mechanism by which a group rules. And so, what is it? How does that work? What are the mechanics of group rule?
Well, at the most basic level, the group rule involves immediately two groups, the majority and the minority. So in the end, rather than the whole group ruling, it's really just the majority that rules.
Well, why is that, King? Why does it always break down that way?
Because with democracy, if you give everyone equal vote, everyone votes, and people who whichever issue you're voting on, I'm going to struggle to put this in a clean fashion, but if there's two groups of people, larger group gets what they want and the smaller group is not.
Okay, all right, so right, you're getting to the key here that I'm looking for is, King, if a group of people is trying to figure out what to do about something, do people gravitate towards unanimity in general in their social affairs? The answer is no. Right? People, especially the more complicated the question, but even with simple questions, people often disagree. And so what happens is when groups try to do something together, they have to have a mechanism for resolving that fact. Right? So when a company wants to decide how they're going to market their product, people disagree, they present different ideas, and then, no, they have to have a way to sort it out. And finally, the CEO or the board of directors will say, this is what we choose. And everybody in the company has to do it if they want to keep working for that company. And in an army, there's a way to resolve, you know, questions of how should things get done. There's an organization, and it's the decision of the general or the leader of the country. And so when you have groups and people are sharing ideas and disputing points of view, which is inevitable among groups of people, you have to have a mechanism. And in democracy, that mechanism is voting. And then as Keane says, inevitably when you vote, you're going to have people who are assenting, who are agreeing to whatever proposition, people who are dissenting. And that breaks down fundamentally into two groups. A majority, well, if you're going to have a group and the most of the people agree to the proposition, that they're going to be in the majority. And then the people who disagree, the smaller of the two, are going to be in the minority. So now technically, or if you think about it, it's kind of an interesting, there's a few interesting logical puzzles to do when it comes to majorities and minorities, right? If we've got 100 people in our society and we want to have a vote, how many is it going to take to form the majority? What group will be large enough to carry the day in any vote? Juliet?
51,
right? If we got 50 and 50, then we have a tie. And then there's no majority, which could happen if you have an even number of voters, right? And that would be a stalemate. There's just no decision made. So you got 51 would be the minimum number of people that would have to agree in a group of 100 so that the people who are agreeing are more than half. Right? So basically a majority means more than half. However many you need to be more than half. So likewise, right, in a group of 1,000, you would need 501. And all of a sudden you've got more than half. So mathematically, how would you express that? What is a majority, mathematically speaking? Anybody want to tackle that question? How are your math skills? How would you describe the need to be more than half in math, right? In a mathematical formula. 6 out of 10 would only be an example of it, Bria, right? 11 out of 20 would be another example. But that's not a definition of it mathematically. You see what I'm driving at, Juliet?
One half plus one.
I would use percentages. I'd say you need 50% plus one. You need 50% plus one. That's a majority. So whatever 50% is of your group, you need one more than that. All right, So that's the way that it works. Now, minorities are also interesting. How big of a majority can you have and still have a minority? Whatever your group is, how small does it get? How unanimous would a decision be, but still have a minority? Or to put it, I guess, more clearly would be, what's the smallest minority? In any group, it's kind of interesting. No matter the size of the group, if you have 1 million people voting, what's the smallest minority? Ben?
One person.
You're going to have 999,999 people on one side, and you're going to have one person on the other side, and, well, you still wouldn't have the whole group agreeing, right? You'd have one person in the minority. And as strange as that sounds, it's very interesting to note that in the history of Athenian democracy, there were multiple cases of this happening, where the majority ganged up on a single individual and punished the individual by vote. And the most infamous example of this, which was a profound injustice, was when the Athenian society decided that Socrates, you'll remember Socrates, one of my heroes who taught by asking questions, they decided that Socrates was an enemy of Athens. He was not, but it was a very stressful time. Athens had just come through a war and they had lost, and they were having a lot of problems in Athens, and Socrates was a philosopher who was asking a lot of really annoying questions of all of the political leaders and showing how ignorant and pretentious they were. And a lot of young people thought he was really cool because, you know how it is. You guys probably, you know, it's a funny thing, but young people have this, while they are still idealistic, and if you are hopefully still idealistic, you kind of have this, you take a certain pleasure in seeing in liars and cheaters and grown-ups who are pretending to know something. It's kind of fun when they are revealed, right? When they're shown to be a liar, or when somebody who's obviously a faker is shown up and proven to be that. It's fun because you know that this person deserves it. And it's, you feel good because, wouldn't be a nice place if the world was a place where liars and cheaters could always get away with it. Then that would be pretty discouraging, right? And Socrates was the kind of guy who would go around and find all the famous politicians and ask them really tough questions and then show everybody that they were really liars and cheaters and pretenders. And that was not appreciated by them. And so they ganged up on him, and they got a majority vote, and they gave him a choice. They said, you can either live in exile, or you have to accept a sentence of death. And so it was a very interesting story in ancient Athens, because the Athenians believed that exile was worse than death. And Socrates believed that too, so he accepted a death sentence. For nothing, he had not committed any crimes. But the people voted that he had corrupted the youth and all kinds of other trumped up things, and they sentenced him to death. So, it was, this is the most fascinating and tragic example of democracy and how it can go wrong. And actually, it by definition, democracy goes wrong. By definition. In the sense that the majority rules. And what's the word there that shows us that something's wrong? What's the word in that very definition of democracy that tells us that there's a problem? Timothy?
Rules.
Rules. What do you mean rules? That's what a king does. So why does it make it right all of a sudden if it just happens to be 50% of the people plus one for people to rule each other? And so this is the puzzle. This is the challenge. And the Athenians were really special people, and they were wonderful. We're going to talk more about a lot of the other things that they created and invented and gave birth to. Because they were special, and it's a tragedy, a lot of what happened to them. But they were very special people, but they didn't see how to make a government that didn't involve somebody ruling somebody else. That was the thing that they didn't quite get. They had a lot of ideas in their society about limits, that they expected certain things to be in a certain way. They hadn't really thought through well enough this idea that if the group rules, if the group has power over the minority, if the majority has power, well, it becomes corrupted just as much as an individual becomes corrupted.
democracies, where to the extent that they can have power over, the majority has power over the minority, becomes corrupted. And so this is the tricky part. It's not easy to see. And nowadays, one thing that makes it more, even more difficult to see is that even though people call the United States a democracy, and even the president will say that, and people around the world will talk about their societies being democratic, they're being very sloppy when they say that. And they are not giving proper recognition and acknowledgement to the thing that actually stops democracies from being as terrible as they can be. They're not giving a proper acknowledgement and recognition to something that stands in the way of the voters and keeps them from doing the terrible things that otherwise they would be corrupted into doing by the very nature of democracy. So, and this is what the founding fathers looked at. They looked at examples like ancient Greece, and they said, individuals like Socrates, they experienced these terrible injustices at the hands of their fellow human beings who are in the majority. Well, because those societies hadn't figured out that there has to be something that the majority cannot do. They haven't figured out how to define and defend some kind of sphere for each individual to live in that's protected from everybody else and any corruption that they might allow themselves to experience and any power that they might try to have over each other. What do we call this? This strange and difficult thing that we want that would make life better. What do we call this thing that would make it so that the majority doesn't have the power to ruin the life of the minority, to have to rule the individual? What do we call this thing? Well, the founding fathers' notion of this was called individual rights. A right, as they understood it, was something that every individual person has and that nobody can take away. And if we understand what those things are, they reasoned, we can make a proper government which will prevent people from having power over each other, which will prevent people from ruling each other. Tricky proposition, very difficult, very, very, very difficult to achieve. And they saw that in ancient times there had been attempts to make this happen. In ancient Athens there were some things they had tried, and in ancient Rome there were things that they had tried as well. And so when it came time to do their job, the founding fathers issued the Declaration of Independence to start things in motion on the 4th of July in 1776. And this is what they said. There are certain inalienable, they use the word unalienable, but a lot of people like to use inalienable instead. They said, people have unalienable rights. This was their key idea. That among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The most American phrase of all time. So what they were saying was, and this word that they used was so, so important to them. What does this mean, unalienable? Priya?
Untouchable?
Pretty close. Keen?
It can't be taken away from you. They're part of you.
They're a part of you. Untakeawayable. Inseparable from your very existence. You are a human being, and therefore these things are a part of you. and cannot be separated from you. They are part of your nature. The men of this time, in this period, they talked about these as being natural rights, being part of human nature, and inalienable. They're part of your nature, therefore they are part of what you are. You can't separate them from you as a person, because you are a person. So you have, as an individual, they said, the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. See, so Socrates, as an individual, if he was living in the time of the founders, they would say, well, you can't vote somebody's life away. That is untakeawayable by the democracy. You can't take away somebody's liberty, and you can't take away their right to pursue their own happiness. Those things are untakeawayable. If you want to live properly, if you want human beings to live in such a way that they are not corrupted by having power over each other, as everybody seems to have made the mistake of doing for thousands and thousands of years, then we got to do something else. We have to live in a way that is fitting towards our nature. So, too bad for Socrates. He had to live in a democracy. Instead, the Founding Father says, we have to make a different kind of government. And the name that they found for this, they called it a republic. And they worked hard at it. We'll talk about the details of it when we get there, because they issued the Declaration of Independence. In that Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson says, the reason for making governments is to secure people's rights. That's what a republic is for. And so then the job is, how do you do it? Well, then they made this constitution. And to reinforce the issue, they made a special set of laws, part of the Constitution, added on to it, called the Bill of Rights. Things that the government can never do. Things that are untakeawayable. See, they were serious about this idea of rights. That was the key to them. Because back in the ancient times, they had some notion of the Romans and the Greeks, you know, working their way towards this. Back here we say that the government of Rome was known as a republic. And what they saw was that the Romans had come up with a number of innovations that helped protect individuals from the power of the mob, from the power of the group, from the power of the majority, from the power of anybody who can control the government. The Romans had come up with some very interesting techniques to make a government that will protect people from each other. So what they saw was that in a republic, a government would have the powers of the different officials separated from each other. We'll talk about this in great detail when we get to the founding of the United States. They said, we're going to create what's called a separation of powers. So nowadays, if somebody makes a law in the United States of America, that's where his role in the laws end. A police officer is only somebody, for instance, who can enforce the law. He does not get to decide what the laws are. So that power of enforcement is separated from the power of making the laws. And as is the power of judging whether or not citizens have broken the law and to what extent the laws are just and whether or not they are rightful laws and so on. That's another power. And judges, and in particular the Supreme Court, are responsible for doing that. So the powers of the government get broken up into multiple different chunks so that nobody has enough power to actually be able to rule anybody. They only have certain powers. They are separated from each other. They are broken up and pitted against each other to prevent the government from being able to rule the citizens. That's one innovation of republics, is the idea of separating the powers. And then the other one is, Bria, hold on one sec. The other one is that you have to make a set of laws, one technique for arranging this protection of rights, is you make a set of laws that the majority cannot change. And the Romans had one of these, and the United States has one of these, and it's called a constitution. A fundamental set of laws, which are virtually permanent. Not entirely, but they are very difficult to change. If you want to change them, you need much more than a majority to do it. You have to get pretty much everybody to accept. We'll talk about that and how that works as well when you get to the American example. But a constitution, which we are going to look at, you know, when we talk about the founding of America, we have the Declaration of Independence, which says what government is for, and the Constitution actually says what the U.S. government is going to be, and how it's going to work. And that doesn't change, hardly ever, because it's very difficult to change. And part of why it can't change is because there's a Bill of Rights that says the government may not do certain things, because there are rights that need to be protected. All right, so we're talking now about a really interesting thought that nobody had until really very, very clearly until the Founding Fathers. The Romans had some good ideas. They saw that if you take the powers of the government and you break them up into little chunks and you separate them out, that helps. And also, if you make a constitution, a set of laws, and nobody's allowed to change it, that helps. So they were thinking about these things. But basically, it was the Founding Fathers who more clearly understood rights are this special protection of the minority, especially the individual, the smallest possible minority, from the majority and its potential corruption. All right, now we're getting. So we've got two really cool ideas. We have one that's an improvement on monarchy, which is democracy. But we can see that, well, it's a problematic concept. It's fragile and it involves a certain corruption. And so the way to deal with that is to institute important limits on the power of that government, and instead to go one step further and make a republic. And the better the job you can do there, the better the individual will be protected, the more freedom everyone will have, the more the people will flourish. And the proof is in the pudding. The freest country in its founding principles is the greatest. That's not an accident. All right. So now we have part of this birth concept of human beings once and for all starting to do things better than this junk over here. Those pharaohs and all those other kings of Mesopotamia and India and China and all that tired old story of people ruling each other. That is sad compared to what is possible. The Athenians and the Romans start to give us a notion that a better life is possible. And if we can learn from their example, we can learn from the founders, we can have an amazing life. Hopefully we will continue to, because we already do. But as Benjamin Franklin said, it's a republic if you can keep it. It's not a republic automatically and forever, no matter what you do or think. Freedom is not normal. And plenty of people have lost it that had it. History shows us that very much. And sadly, the Athenians and the Romans both lost it. Which is why we have to have a dark age, why we have to have a rebirth, and finally get to our American Declaration. History sometimes can take torturously long to get from a terrible mistake or tragedy to a correction and a rebirth of a good approach. So once you've got something wonderful, you're better off just not losing it. It can be really hard to get it back. It can take a 1,000-year dark age to even get started on the problem. All right, good luck to us in that task as we seek to learn from those who came before and hopefully secure this republic. That's it for today. We'll continue with our theme of the birth before the rebirth tomorrow. Last thoughts, questions? Anybody? Keen, go ahead, sir.
Okay, I don't want to put any extra pressure on you, but when can I expect my test?
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate, I need the pressure. Yeah, I have pressure from all directions, so I'm going to say this weekend. All right. And if I don't get it, you can embarrass me in class some more. Okay, what else? That was good. All right. Thanks, everybody. Talk to you tomorrow. Bye for now.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
No, thank you.